105 Drive with Julian Clover.
Cambridge 105, community radio in your city, and 39 years after the last Poirot novel was published, we have a new story. It's called The Monogram Murders. It's written by Sophie Hannah, already an international best-selling author and an honorary fellow of Lucy Cavendish College, and I'm pleased to say that she's with me now. Hello, Sophie.
Hi.
Thank you very much for coming in. I'm glad you made it and sort of navigated your way around the streets. So let's start with the process here. As I understand it, very much with the blessing of the Agatha Christie estate. But, yes. But who approached who? How does this sort of thing work?
I don't know how it normally works. In this case, it worked completely weirdly and differently. So what happened was, completely by chance, two things happened at exactly the same time. Agatha Christie's family and estate started to think that now might be the time to consider doing what they'd never wanted to do in the past, commission a new Poirot or Miss Marple novel. And at the same time, my agent happened to be in HarperCollins's office and they saw lots of Agatha Christie's on the shelves. And my agent said, oh, I've got an author who's a huge Agatha Christie fan. You should get her to write a new Agatha Christie novel. And the editor said, oh, well, you know, we'd never be able to. The family wouldn't want anything like that to happen. And then the next day, that editor had a meeting with the family and the estate. And the estate said, you know, we're starting to think maybe it's time. And the editor said, well, an agent yesterday said to me that he's got an author who's an obsessive Agatha Christie fan. So we all had a meeting and it went from there, really.
How did your interest in Agatha Christie start in the first place?
I discovered Agatha Christie when I was 12. My father bought me a second-hand copy of The Body in the Library from a book fair, second-hand book fair, and I read it, got hooked, and sent him out to buy more from other book fairs. He used to go to quite a few, so I said, Dad, every time you go to a book fair, find me a battered Agatha Christie. And I think before I was 14, I had a full collection and had read them all.
I think it's funny. I remember discovering, I think I'd probably been round about the same age, maybe slightly older, a collection of book club books, which
yes.
had been acquired, I think, by my aunt, and we'd somehow gotten hold of them. And of course, it was just absolutely full of Agatha Christie, and it was like an amazing discovery. Really, it progressed, you know, instantly from Famous Five across
to
something far more sophisticated.
Yep, that was it was Secret Seven in my case.
Yeah, no, it's Secret Seven here too as well. It was.
I got really hooked on mysteries from a very young age because of the Secret Seven books, and then Agatha Christie was my first sort of grown-up crime writer that I discovered.
So when you sat down to do the writing, was it a matter of, you know, swatting up, if you like, going back and rereading? How much of Sophie Hannah, the storyteller, is in there, and how much does it feel like an old-fashioned Agatha Christie novel might?
Well, it's very hard for me to be objective as the person who wrote it, but I would say both, and certainly reviewers have said so too, that basically it feels very much like a golden age set in 1929 Agatha Christie novel. Some reviewers have said you forget that it's not by Agatha Christie, which is great. But other reviewers have said you can see that I'm in there too. You know, some of the aspects of the story are reminiscent of other things in my work. So I would say it's kind of, you know, a blend of the two.
Sort of merging themselves together. Now, I was just wondering, because Poirot has ended, I guess, the big deal at the turn of the year, I think, about David Suchet giving up the role of them doing the last book.
Yes.
Made me wonder, actually, as to whereabouts in Poirot's career the Monogram Murders is actually set.
Right, so Agatha Christie killed off Poirot at the end of Curtain.
That's the question, really.
And David Suchet played that part, and so Poirot is now dead. And I wasn't going to bring him back to life and undo Agatha Christie's creative decision. But there's a gap in Poirot's timeline. Between 1928 and 1932, Agatha Christie didn't write any Poirot novels, and Poirot is unaccounted for during that period. So I and the estate and the publishers agreed that it would make sense to set the Monogram Murders in 1929.
So how much checking then was involved with the estate? Was it a matter of saying, right, here's my storyline, this is where it's going, what do you think? You know, how many times did somebody from the estate have to flick through and see what was going on?
Hardly ever. And I think that was because from the very first meeting that we had, it was clear that we were all on the same page. So If I'd said I want to write a modernised Poirot where he's on a spaceship and, you know, he's a belly dancer, you know, then I think the estate would have said, hang on a minute, we're not letting you do this, and if you do it, we want to see it every week to check you're not doing anything too crazy. I said right from the start that the thing about a project like this, which is known in the trade as a continuation project, is that it has to be familiar enough to please fans and indeed purists who don't want their favourite things changed, but different enough so that it's something new. And I made it very clear from the start that what I intended to do was keep Poirot exactly as he is in his period, Agatha Christie's Poirot in every particular, and that the newness and the innovation was going to come in the form of the storyline. So all the exciting new bits are the case, the mystery, the clues, the suspects, is he going to solve it? That's where the newness comes in. Poirot is absolutely going to be traditional Poirot. And I said this to the family, and that was exactly what they wanted to hear. They agreed. And so actually they saw a plan, which was a sort of plot outline before I started, and then they saw the first draft, and then they obviously saw the final draft. But they've been great at every stage. They've been incredibly supportive, and they've just said, brilliant, wonderful, we love it. So it's been really nice.
And do we meet the reoccurring characters who we would find in the Agatha Christie's Poirot books as well?
No, so Poirot is the only character from Agatha Christie's fiction. I didn't want to use Hastings as a narrator and sidekick because Hastings was in the first person talking in Agatha Christie's books, and my first person Hastings would have inevitably been slightly different.
You think I might have given the game away, as it were?
I mean, in a way, I didn't want there to be any game to give away. I wanted to approach it in a way that felt much more genuine. So I'm a new author writing Poirot, and it seemed totally appropriate, therefore, that he should have a new sidekick, and that sidekick's voice would be different from Hastings' voice because they're two different people, just as Agatha and I are two different people. So that felt to me like a really sensible way to solve that problem.
I found it very descriptive. I've only read the first little bit, I'm afraid, but it was, you know, as he sits in the cafe, and I'm not giving away too many plot spoilers, I don't think, here, and is introduced to, I think it's in the publicity material, so we can say this as well, is introduced to a woman who said she's as good as already dead, and that sort of sparks, presumably, that leads on to development of the story.
She says someone's chasing her and going to kill her, and that if that happens, Poirot must make sure that nobody solves the crime. She doesn't want her murderer to be punished. She says once she's dead, justice will finally have been done. Poirot, of course, finds this alarming and intriguing, and so sticks his oar in.
And already you've got two mysteries for the price of one, really, there, haven't you?
Exactly.
I like the little bit about, you know, Poirot rearranging the cutlery on the table in front of him. I can sort of imagine that sort of thing.
Yes, well, he would hate to sit at a table with messy cutlery, as I do. I'm quite OCD-ish about tidiness, so I was able to empathise with Poirot.
Going along those lines. I think some of your previous work has been filmed for television.
Yes, two of my psychological thrillers have been filmed and have been shown on ITV1 under the series title Case Sensitive.
So I guess the question which follows is there any chance that Mr. Suchet might be tempted out of retirement?
I don't know, but I would imagine that somebody will at some point ask him. I don't know. He said he's finished with doing Poirot, but at the point when he said that, he didn't know there was going to be another book. So
I was going to say, he was interviewed by our own Mandy Morton a few months back, and he was talking at that point about a gap in the filming when basically ITV had decided for a few years that they weren't going to do any more. So I guess there is the possibility, shall we say, that he could return.
I don't know. He certainly hasn't said that, and he certainly has said that he's finished with Poirot, so who knows?
I'll find out. What's your next project? Do you take a rest after something has been completed? How does
no,
it work?
I never take a rest. I'm just about to finish my next psychological thriller, which is called A Game for All the Family, and is coming out next April.
And are you stepping back into Agatha Christie's shoes, or is that decided?
Well, I haven't heard any mention of it. I mean, I think we've all been so focused on this book and so excited about it that we haven't planned any further than one book.
OK, well, Sophie Hannah, thank you very much for coming in and chatting to Cambridge 105. The Monogram Murders, it's published by HarperCollins, and it is, I guess, as they say, available in all good bookstores.
105 Drive with Julian Clover. Cambridge
105. 12 minutes past 4 o'clock. I shall introduce you to my first guest of the afternoon. Her name is Julie Braithwaite. She's been down this afternoon at the Grand Arcade. Were you there this morning as well?
We got there pretty early, yeah.
What time did you start?
We started at 9, and we're there till 6 o'clock this evening.
Okay, well, anyway, good afternoon. You're most welcome.
Thank you very much.
And I gather Cambridge is one of 15 cities across the UK. You're with Cancer Research UK, and it's called March on Cancer. So explain what this one's about then.
No, absolutely correct. Basically, every 2 years, and it was basically 2 years ago, we brought a new concept into the UK, which the concept came from America, and that was Stand Up to Cancer. And Stand Up to Cancer is on October this year. And as a prelude to that, the week prior, we've organised 15 simultaneous marches on cancer that's operating in 15 cities around the country. And it's basically an introduction to the telethon that occurs the week prior, the week,
right,
week following.
Right.
So, yeah, the March on Cancer is on the 11th of October. It's basically starting at 7:30, Queen's Green. And the idea is, again, to promote the Stand Up to Cancer that's happening the week following.
And a nice little tour around the city, I gather, seeing if people who want hopefully a pleasant October's evening walk around.
Yeah, it'll be nice if it's a nice, pleasant October's evening. As I say, it starts at 7:30. It's starting at Queen's Green. We follow the backs up Garrett Hostel Lane, through Trinity Street, up to St John Street, then on to Sydney Street. And the idea is it's an interactive experience, so at various stages of the march, there's like an element that's introduced. So we're starting off with it being reflective, and then there's an element of defiance where we're fighting cancer. And then towards the end of the march, it's more celebratory and optimistic, because obviously we're finding cures every single day, and therefore we're celebrating. But as I say, it's open to families, men, women and children, and at each stage at the course there's a fun element or an experience to be had.
I guess one of the good things about organising it in this way, we hear lots of, I don't know, 5k, 10k runs, walks and high. This is a relatively short distance, so if you can't, not necessarily the fittest of people, you can actually manage to do the march and presumably raise some money as well as the awareness along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously I'm the event manager for the Race for Life in Cambridge that runs through the city streets in the summer, and that's obviously a 5k event. And while they're not competitive, there is an element of women.
Oh, I don't know. I've interviewed some people who have come first. I think they're fairly competitive.
Oh, yeah. No, the lead runners are pretty competitive, and obviously they judge their times. But as a rule, we don't promote it as a competitive event.
Right.
But women still feel they need to run it. And however much we try and say you can walk, jog, run it, dance, or do it every way you like, there's still an element of that. So the March on Cancer, while it's not strictly a march, it's more like a sedate walk, I guess, is a 45-minute walk around the city streets. But as I say, it's no running. So that's why we're promoting it to men, women and children.
I guess Amble doesn't look as good on the posters, really, does
it?
As the,
no,
as
we
the
wanted
thing.
To make it a defiant stance, because obviously our branding's changed quite a lot in the past year, and it was introducing that defiant element to it. And as you say, if we'd put a gentle stroll through the streets of Cambridge, it doesn't have quite the same power as March.
It's interesting because, you know, the typography you've got and some of the promotional materials people might have seen involving some of the Channel 4 people, Davina McCall, for example, it's actually quite edgy in terms of the typography and the style of it all, which is a lot, you know, it's a lot different from, you know, it's getting a pin badge for your lapel.
Absolutely, yeah. I think there was a need for it, really. I mean, obviously our branding had been pretty constant for the last few years, and that suited where we were at that time. But obviously, we're the only charity in the country that researches into all 200 types of cancer, and we are making inroads now. And whereas before we weren't confident to say that we could beat it, now we're getting there. We are, every day making inroads into beating cancer. So we felt that our typography and our branding ought to reflect that. So I know Davina, apparently, I hadn't seen it myself, but she was on the £1 million drop the other day and mentioned the fact of March, and she's already done the bites promoting the March on Cancer itself that's coming up on obviously the 11th of October. And more people are now becoming involved. Cancer itself is more commonplace, more people are aware of it, But we still can't do the research without the funding, and we are really heavily reliant on the community support for doing that. So there's a constant need to introduce new events, to get people stimulated, to get people involved, to create awareness, and our March on Cancer is just one of those many forms. Mm.
And another one, of course, you've been in Cambridge this afternoon at the Grand Arcade, putting your Doc Martens on.
Yes. Yeah, so obviously we launched the march today. The Doc Martens was basically putting your mark, your stamping on cancer, we're marching on it. So it was painting the sole of the Doc Martens boot and stamping all over our message template on the floor. And it was just saying, you know, you've made your mark, you could sign it. That's going to be promoted all over our social media websites later on. Very kindly, the Cambridge Evening News came down, took some photographs, so you'll see that in the local press tomorrow. Yeah, it's one thing. And also to encourage people to engage with us. We, you know, we love talking to people and desperately need more volunteers to come and help at our events. So we're really fortunate in that Cambridge has been so supportive of us and the Grand Arcade so supportive of us that...
I think we're something like finished. Second only to Bedford in terms of generosity. I think that was the stat which came out a few weeks ago.
I'm not surprised at all, but yeah, no, we're very, very lucky. Very, very lucky to have that support.
Did you put some old sheets down on the floor of the Grand Arcade? Because it's quite nice floors there and I wouldn't want them to get damaged.
Yeah, there was a few rules we had to abide by, but they've been really good with us. So we had some matting down. And as I said, but the actual template itself is like 5 by 5 metres big, so there was a pretty big space. And we were giving away obviously balloons and just promoting it itself, but no, it was good fun. Lots of children got involved. It was a good fun activity.
So Julie, remind me of the date of the march, and more importantly how people can sign up and get involved for all
absolutely.
Of that.
So it's Saturday the 11th of October. It starts at 7:30 p.m. you'd need to be there about 7. It's £5 to register, and you can register that online. There is a number of registrations we can take on the day, but I ideally would like you to go online, and look forward to seeing you there, really.
That's great. Well, Julie, thank you very much for coming in and telling us all about that. Safe journey back home tonight.
No, thank you very much. Yeah.
Good luck on the traffic. We'll update you on that after Mr. Probes. That was Julie Braithwaite of Cancer Research UK.